Imagine earning continuing education credits while doing exactly what you're doing right now. Well, you can. Gable Media has revolutionized the way you earn your continuing education credits with a groundbreaking approach. Forget running around town and scouring the internet for credit-worthy courses. Fulfill your CE requirements effortlessly by listening to engaging podcasts just like the one you're listening to now. Our podcasts are designed to educate, entertain, and inspire, all in a user-friendly environment. But wait, there's more. Architects, Gable Media is also approved as an AIA Continuing Education Services provider. Upon completion, we handle everything, from reporting your hours directly to the AIA to storing your certificates in your personal Gable Media profile for your self-reporting needs. So follow the link in the show notes and start earning your credits in the most innovative and entertaining way possible with Gable Media.
Thank you to BQE, the makers of BQE Core, for their support of this episode. BQE Core is the software that makes it easy to manage your projects and people for maximum productivity and ultimate profitability. Learn more at bqe.com. Context and Clarity has been called a community-based pro practice masterclass for architects. It's awfully high praise, but since we began this journey back in April of 2020, we've certainly grown into a community of small firm architects, all focused on what matters most to their success. And by the way, it doesn't matter if you're the employee of a firm that's dreaming of going out on your own, or you've owned your own firm for 26 years. There's something here for everyone. And that's where you come in. Thanks for listening, and welcome to the Context and Clarity podcast. Every week, we have a conversation with an expert or a thought leader on things that matter most to the success of architects just like you. Then we go backstage with someone from our community and we talk about what we learned, what our biggest takeaways were, and how we're going to apply what we heard to our own businesses. Hey, Context and Clarity community. We've reached midsummer and we're taking a couple of weeks off. But I didn't want to leave you without a podcast episode because you might be traveling or sitting by a lake or on a beach, and you might want something to listen to. So we're bringing back one of the most requested past episodes of Context and Clarity Live. This conversation is with Christine Williamson. If you don't know her, Christine is the founder and the host of the Building Science Fight Club. She's trained as an architect, and she's leveraged her passion for building science into a new way to both support the profession, but also give us better, healthier places to live and work. I think what's interesting about this conversation is that we didn't just talk about building science, but also about how architects get information, how you're trained, and how you learn. All that being said, I thought this was a great conversation with Christine and worth bringing back. So I hope that you enjoy it as much as I did. Christine Williamson, welcome to Context and Clarity Live.
Hey, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us today. I wanted to start the conversation today, I think, by asking, why Building Science Fight Club?
What do you mean, why? Like the name or the concept itself? Or
The whole concept.
The whole concept? I mean, it really started as a... So Instagram's a photo sharing app, or that's what I understood of it. I mean, I'm sure there's much more to it. There certainly is much more to it now, but it's a photo sharing app, and what we do is very visual. And when my career path kind of diverged from my classmates in architecture school, and that mine had more of a, I was certainly on site, on job sites a lot more. And I had a focus on the more technical aspects of architecture in terms of how physically stuff gets put together in the field. And a lot of my classmates just didn't get that. And as I was learning this too, it's very hard to learn this. You feel really in over your head a lot. And so as I'm learning this and teaching myself and learning from other people, I thought I would get questions from my classmates who were also struggling, but they weren't in the same position as I was in order to be able to actually answer those questions. So they were just relying on what their colleagues would tell them, and hopefully their colleagues were right. or their principal or whatever. And anyway, so I'd get questions from them. And I thought, you know, wouldn't it be kind of cool if as I'm learning this stuff, like as I'm learning it, what if I were to take photos on my job sites and like, you know, mark them up, just this kind of stuff I'd put on a site visit report and say stuff like, this is the flashing or whatever it might be, with a really brief technical description about what it is that I'm seeing, and to help sort of fill that site project experience gap that a lot of architects experience, particularly early in their careers. But it also continues, because you don't, I think the way the profession is organized, a lot of architects really don't end up learning stuff in the field at the same pace as they learn other skills. Mm-hmm. And consequently feel kind of outmatched, right? It's like this gap where their confidence, their experience, their level of knowledge in all of these other areas is just growing exponentially, particularly at the beginning of their careers. And then there's this giant gaping hole that feels kind of significant, like how we actually build stuff. Everybody kind of thinks that's important. And to have that experience and that knowledge not grow at the same pace as the other learning that occurs in this profession. So anyway, I started doing it really for friends. I was learning myself, and it was this spirit. You know what it is? It was studio culture. It was exactly studio culture, but in the real world. And it was, so how can I sort of help my friends? And it became sort of bigger and bigger. And then it wasn't just my friends. It was their friends and their friends' friends. So now it's pretty big. Now, of course, it's gotten a lot more. I've invested from all kinds of weird twists of fate in life have permitted me to invest more in the project as it became more successful and bigger anyway. So it's quite a bit more formal now. It's not just me snapping photos and marking them up. I put a lot of thought into it. It's more like writing a newsletter or an article or something like that. It's each post is its own project, but it's pretty fun. So yeah, that's how it started. It was pretty humble beginnings. And I mean, it still is now. It's here, it's me and my staff of disobedient little pooches who don't contribute very much to the project. But you know, that's how a lot of fun things happen, I think.
Yeah. Well, I think it's interesting, you know, talking about your friends and then the friends of your friends. And it struck me as you were saying that this tracks almost exactly like Fight Club, the movie, right?
So. Oh, right. I haven't seen the movie yet, everybody. So.
Oh, it's good.
So in relation to your social media, people will have a lot of questions about that. Like, you know, Pam wants to know, who are most of your followers? They, a contractor told me about it. So are they architects? Are they contractors? Are they homeowners, or are they just?
So they're mostly architects and architects in training. Although there's a lot of contractors and builders, some kind of geeky homeowners who I love. I love people who geek out on their homes and get into this stuff. It started with my actual friends. So definitely architects in training. I don't think any of us were. I'm still not licensed. I don't think my friends were licensed at the time that I started the account. Maybe one or two of them. This was, there's a lot of, obviously there's been lots of changes with NCARB and the order you can take these exams and all kinds of stuff, but I don't think any of my friends were licensed even close to graduation. So it was architects in training for the most part. And then I suppose beyond that, contractors kind of latched on at the beginning. But it's tempting in social media world to live by sort of social media rules instead of what maybe might come more naturally to in-person communities. And in that, like at the very beginning, when people were starting to follow the account and it was getting more attention, you're sort of tempted to speak to the audience that's there rather than to the people that you want to speak to, or that you're like, I have a particular area of interest and expertise, and I'm certainly comfortable speaking to contractors, and I like contractors a lot, but I don't really think that contractors and builders have the same needs when it comes to architectural education that architects do. Architects are approaching this from a really different perspective, and I really think that they're underserved in adult education. And so I wanted to, I don't know if somebody told me this. I can't remember if I just did it, but I just said, well, I'm gonna speak. So there was a point where it was, the account was more popular among builders, and I was like, well, I'm just gonna speak as though I'm speaking only to architects, and we'll just see what happens. And then gradually, then suddenly, like lots of things in life, the audience is definitely dominated by architects and architects in training now, which is good, because I think our needs really are different in the field. The example I like to give is that, like, a contractor might prefer a solution to a particular problem that is more labor intensive but less expensive. And an architect might prefer, because the contractor is in control of what's happening on the job site and can say, okay, I understand what you're saying. I understand what we're trying to achieve. And I know how to do that. I can do that. I'm capable of that. I know my capabilities. Whereas a contractor or an architect doesn't have the same amount of control on a job site. And when we're making design decisions, we're often doing it before we even know who the contractor is, or what kind of client this person is going to turn out to be. So we might favor a design solution to a problem that's maybe a little bit more expensive, but more reliable from a labor and installation perspective. And it's important to acknowledge that and to I think teach in that way. Architects have a different, and designers in general have a different role. And I don't know too many people who really acknowledge the importance of that difference. So that's one of the things I seek to specifically address for architects. Sometimes I think people maybe misunderstand. They think, like, when I have a course that I teach for architects, and I think sometimes people misunderstand. It's like, well, could a builder take it? Could a homeowner take it? Well, yeah, of course you can take it. But it's really directed for the responsibilities and background of this particular community. And it's not meant to deliberately exclude anyone. It's just meant to address these particular needs.
I know when I say this, I'm in danger of going down my own rabbit hole here, but I think that's a really important branding message for architects. I talk about ideal client all the time. Don't spend any time in the branding and marketing world. Yeah, we're talking about attracting the ideal client, et cetera. But what you're talking about is providing content for, and that's the parallel, is don't spend any time trying to attract your non-ideal client, someone that's not your ideal client. Produce and speak to and design for and all of those things specifically for your ideal client. And if that excludes others, fine. But at least you're serving your ideal, and that's the important part. Or the important point. So I really applaud that approach, because it's I looked it up this morning, 72 or 74,000 followers on Instagram. 74. There you go. 74,000. It seems to be attracting the right people at this point.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. I'm really delighted by the community and the people who ask really great questions and provide really good comments. It's not a perfect platform for that particular community, so there's some real limitations to it, but it's also really unexpectedly rich in the type of learning that you might really not expect it from social media, which is so funny, right? Because, like, I remember back before social media, before really even the internet, and I remember being in school, like a kid, and hearing about old enough to know stuff. And I was so confused, like, the information superhighway, what? I just didn't understand the imagery to that. But I remember, like, that's what people sold the internet as. It was, you know, people, you'll be able to read any book from all across the world, and it'll connect you to all these great ideas. And of course, the internet is turned out to be that and a whole lot of other messy, crazy stuff. But yeah. I think there's some really cool opportunities out there for genuinely enriching experiences. And for a whole lot of people, Instagram's become that. So that's kind of nice. But I also started doing this via email too. So if anybody, not everybody is on Instagram, and that's, I get that. So I started emailing the same posts that I post once a week via email. And it was sort of funny. The first week I did it, I got a really nice note from an architect. I thank you so much. I'm on Instagram, but only one of my offices is on Instagram. And I love at least being able to, like, I'm reading the same post, but I'm reading it from my computer screen rather than my phone. So I look more productive in my office. So anyway, plus it's bigger. People can take a little bit more time with it. It's a fun little thing. I'm still enjoying it. I'm not to scare people, but there's certainly, it takes a long time for me to do this, and I'm not sure that I'll be able to keep it up I certainly will not be able to keep it up in its current form forever and ever, but no plans on stopping anytime soon.
That brings up a great point. What are you trying to accomplish? And is there an end game? You know, is there something bigger even, or maybe even bigger than yourself in your goals for building Science Fight Club?
I have a lot of goals. I'm not a particularly great businesswoman. So some people have asked me this, including like family members who love me and want me to be successful and happy and stuff. They'll ask me questions about that. And I feel like just through the questions, I'm like, oh yeah, I have not thought this through. So some of this is really just instinct. I do what is fun for me, and it's been fine so far. So that's good. But no, at the outset, it really was sort of an educational, helpful hobby. And it would help other people, which I like very much, but it also helped me in that when you're teaching a concept to someone else, you really do learn it in a different way yourself. And a big part of my business now as then is, I mean, really all of us are in the business of communicating concepts about things that don't necessarily yet exist in the physical world yet. And so being a better communicator about complex things is a helpful thing. So I was getting that out of it. I was, and I was helping other people. So it seemed like a pretty harmless, fun diversion. Like, if I'm going to use social media anyway, this is a pretty good way of doing it. So that's how it really started. And then, now of course it takes me, somebody else asked, I could see in the chat, like, how long do these posts take? Like, probably between 10 and 20 hours per post now, which is, I can't keep doing that for fun. That's not a forever model. Now, what I have found is, so I started doing that when I was, I'm an immigrant to the United States. I'm Canadian, and I came to the US for college. And have always been on some sort of work visa or another that I would have to renew. But I guess just about 3 years ago, I married an American. And through marriage, I was finally able to apply for a green card. And so I applied for a green card. And this is a much longer, less interesting, very complicated story. But it resulted in me knowing that I would not be able to work for a period. This is not true for every immigrant. It's true for some, and it was true for me. But I had this like almost year-long period where I was not allowed to make money. I could work. I couldn't make money though. And so I took, couldn't be paid, or I couldn't be on a salary. Anyway, I didn't have authorization, and you're never really sure how long this period is going to be before you get approval and all this other stuff. Anyway, and you can actually sort of see, you can guess where this transition happened if you're scrolling through my Instagram feed, because I ended up having the time to really make a bigger commitment to the Instagram feed. But it wasn't so much, I wasn't deciding like, okay, I'm going to commit to growing an Instagram feed for the sake of having a large following. It was really this belief that, like I said before, that continuing education for architects is really not very, in my view, helpful or well-developed in a lot of ways, particularly in the building science side of things. In that most of it, I think, is really, we outsource it to materials manufacturers. So the majority of the education after our formal education in school, our professional education is really developed by these materials manufacturers. And they actually do a pretty good job of it, I think. A lot of them do. But I believe they can't be the only option for us. And I think that a big part of why a lot of these educational materials are not really reaching architect practicing professionals in a really good way is because they're not developed for that purpose. They're developed for, these educational things are part of a marketing effort. Yeah. And I thought, well, what if I pursued education as its own good and I treated it like its own business? So what if I made my job during this time where I can't make money anyway? What if I treated teaching in this professional capacity? What if I treated that as a job? What would it look like to teach architects if you could actually not, because we're all billing by hour. A lot of us do hourly billing and stuff. So I was in that hourly model for so long. And I could only, I did teach before when I was doing regular consulting work, but I could only devote the number of hours to prepare for a presentation that the payment justified, right? It was, what was my fee for the speaking engagement divided by my billable rate? Like that's, so whatever that, if it's 6 hours, that's all I had to prepare. 6 hours. Like, and I would try to actually be disciplined enough to stay within that, because otherwise everybody listening knows this on the billable. Oh, you're like a slave to your timesheet. It's terrible. Anyway, so I thought, well, what if I didn't have to do that anymore? And then I had this opportunity to not do that anymore. I couldn't make money anyway. So what if I invested what I, not based on what the billable rate called for, but what I believed the content demanded, the actual, like, what would it actually take to produce something better? What would it look like? So that's what I did. I sort of gave myself an unpaid internship for a year, thanks to the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. And that's when Building Science Fight Club got a lot more polished. But the idea was also to use that content in other ways and to teach in other settings. So during that time, I was posting on Instagram, but I was also developing a curriculum to teach architects when I came back to when I was allowed to work. So I launched that about 6 months ago, last Thanksgiving or so. And it's been really successful, but it had to be on demand because I really like what I do. So I still wanted to be able to actually consult. I love teaching, but I wanted something that was a resource that wasn't just dependent on my hours, right? On my availability. So that's sort of how that happened. Now I forget what your original question was, but that's what I do. Well,
it was kind of about the goals, what the future is, but you just said a lot of really interesting things, but there are a couple of things that stand out. Right now, up on the screen, there's a question that Erica asked. She says, are you able to monetize your social media popularity in any way? And what I would, that's definitely an interesting question. What I would also say is, are you monetizing the actual social media? And or is the Instagram, is it driving some other ROI, like people to the course that you mentioned a minute ago, or even to clients?
Yeah, so consulting. Two things. So the consulting business, when I knew that I wanted to consult on my own privately, so that was my first sort of, I think a lot of us professionally have that long-term goal is to be independent, have your own firm. And so that was mine too. And my number one fear with that, like anybody who starts a business like that, is where am I going to get clients? Mm-hmm. Am I going to be, so I start my business and then nobody calls. You're like, great. So that was my biggest fear. And that turned out not to be a problem for me. I think even absent having a large Instagram following, but I do not do the Instagram to get clients for consulting. I learned that as a sole practitioner, I don't actually need that many jobs to to, I mean, I guess if I'm trying to have launched this empire, if my goal were to get really rich, this would not be my strategy. But if my goal is to do what I like and earn an income and run and have the independence of running my own business, I don't need the Instagram as a promotional vehicle for that at all. So that was something that was sort of surprising that I didn't know about before. In terms of monetizing the Instagram account, I really do not want to do that. I'm about that. I think if I were a younger person, I would be, I'm actually really glad that I'm not. I have a birthday coming up in like a month and I'm very delighted to have some of the really good things that come with age, because I think you sort of, a lot of times if you have some sort of talent or skill or opportunity, you assume that you have to take it. And this isn't, yes, having a large Instagram account or following is an opportunity, but you don't have to take it. And that is not a good fit for my personality. It doesn't make me happy. Even thinking about it now makes me feel sort of stressed out. And also I just don't want to do that. I don't want that plays into more of the sponsorship model, the corporate sponsorship model of education. And I really just, I want to do something different. And I think it's very hard to maintain your credibility when your content is directly sponsored by materials manufacturers. Now, I have thought it would be cool if I could get non-architectural sponsors for the Instagram account. Like, I don't know, if American Express wants to sponsor Building Science Fight Club, that would be fine. They could write me a check. I'd be very happy. Or Whole Foods, brought to you by Whole Foods. We could have like a trade, maybe. Like, I maintain a trade deficit with Whole Foods every week. But anyway, so I really value my independence, and I'm just not interested in doing that. And I don't think it would be enjoyable. I don't think it'd be that profitable, honestly, for what it would take. That it would require me to be to run the kind of business that I don't actually want to run. I don't want to be a social media. I don't want to have the most successful Instagram social media account for among architects. It's not the business I want to start. Not that there's anything wrong with that business, but that's not, I don't want to do that. I like teaching. So I want to teach. Now as a business decision, does it put me in a less successful position if I'm teaching my own classes? So architects are not receiving subsidized education. They're paying for it themselves. Maybe, but I also think the things that you invest in yourself are in a lot of ways more valuable to you. So it makes me really, really proud to have put a lot of effort into developing a curriculum that I ask architects for $750 for of their own money. Most of us are in small firms, and it's not like, you know, Gensler's paying the bills for all of us for this kind of stuff. And to hear that individual architects running their own businesses find that their practice is positively influenced by a class that they took from me, you couldn't even pay me a better compliment. And they're not just paying the money. It's like a 10-hour course. They're investing 10 hours with me of their own time, and to hear that that's actually been genuinely beneficial for people, I'm just so proud of that. And I certainly hope that it's very, very successful. And I think that there's definitely a business case for doing it. I don't think it's unreasonable for a sizable percentage of the registered architects in the United States to take my course over the next 10 years. If, you know, there's 115,000 or 120,000 registered architects in the U.S. and a bunch of others like me who are in the profession and designers but not licensed yet. If I don't think it's unreasonable that 5 or 10% of them over the next 10 years would take a course from me. And that's a pretty good model for me. That's pretty nice. Apart from sponsorship. So no, I haven't monetized it. I'm sure it certainly doesn't hurt having a big following. And I don't know what the post-COVID world is going to look like, and materials manufacturers, I'm certain, will pay me. They did this before to speak at specific conferences, and I will very happily take money to do that. But the idea isn't the idea is still very educational. And so like a lot of architects, right? Entree architects, how many of your members are looking to start an empire, and how many of them are really just trying to run a business they like to run and have a nice quality of life and spend some time with their kids and pursue other interests and hobbies that are important to them and have a full life.
Let's take a quick break to share more about our sponsors, Systems and Standard Operating Procedures. You already know that's how to build a profitable business and find the freedom that you want. You need systems and procedures, but you struggle with choosing which systems you need the most and how to implement those systems quickly so that you can get back to doing what you love to do the most. The Designing Your Business Masterclass series was created by acclaimed architect and business consultant Douglas Teager, FAIA, to help fellow architects and engineers run their firms more profitably while maintaining a healthy work-life balance. Douglas grew from a solo practitioner to becoming managing partner of his 30-plus person firm, and then later sold his firm so that he can do what he does today, helping architects be more successful at Teager Consulting. On the third Wednesday of every month, Douglas dives deep into an essential topic that will strengthen the profitability of your firm and make it sustainable for growth in the years to come. Register now for the next Designing Your Business Masterclass with Douglas Teager at bqe.com/masterclass. And then start implementing powerful systems for the profitability you need and the freedom you want. Every live masterclass session includes AIA continuing education credit. And when you visit bqe.com/masterclass, you'll have access to the full library of past sessions on demand. The Designing Your Business Masterclass is free. It's brought to you by our friends at BQE, the makers of BQE Core, the software that makes it easy to manage your projects and your people for maximum productivity and ultimate profitability. Register now for the next Designing Your Business Masterclass at bqe.com/masterclass. That's bqe.com/masterclass. And now, let's get back to the conversation.
What's the percentage breakdown on that, Jeff? Empire versus good life.
It's probably 99% good life and
1%. I'd go for empire. I'm going to go for empire. So.
Go for empire. I'm glad to be empire developers.
We have to make choices.
But I don't want to be you.
I already see this playing out, because what I hear Christine saying is she is never going to have a TikTok version of Building Science Fight Club, because that would mean that she's having to create these TikToks all the time, which would not be all that different, but they have a better monetization strategy. But you're right, you would turn your business into creating TikToks. Now Catherine already has a TikTok empire. So she's already starting to build her empire.
I've been neglecting my empire, honestly, lately. So, but, you know, people.
I found my doctor is a TikTok, like has a bunch of TikTok. I don't really understand the whole thing, but anyway, that was sort of funny to see my actual like lab coat doctor doing these dance video stuff. Anyway,
it's not all dancing. I'm just going to say that. But you know what?
He's a good dancer. So
is he? What's his name?
Yeah, he was great. I was very impressed. Well, I don't want to tell you. I don't want to.
Well, he's TikTok famous already. So, I mean,
TikTok famous already.
Well, I guess. Yeah. Now I'm just going to have to wonder if every doctor I see on there is your doctor. That's okay. Yeah. So people are.
They're all my doctor, Catherine. They're all mine.
People are clamoring for a book of your content. Is that a possibility?
Yes, it is. I definitely would like to write one. It's just, I'm sort of struggling to find my footing in terms of time management with this stuff, where I still am running an actual business where I have actual clients that I should occasionally answer. And anyway, all this is to say, yes, I plan on doing a book, but I haven't found the time quite yet.
You know, you mentioned the course, right, for the emerging professionals or some of these others. And So one of the things that we do with Context and Clarity is we start the conversation every morning at 9 a.m. on Clubhouse. And so we'll do a half-hour coffee talk on Clubhouse. And we sort of did a preview of this conversation this morning. The reason I like to do that is because I hear from the audience in real time in their voice what they really care about, what they really want to know about the topic of the day. And so we started that conversation this morning and someone asked, and I apologize, I forget who asked this question. I think it was actually a couple of people asked the same or similar question, which was something like, what's the big gap or what's the typical gap, right? You see, no matter where they go to school, there you go. What are the big gaps understanding that architects have, right? They come out of school, a BArch or an MArch or, you know, whatever their curriculum was. What's the gap between what they learned in school and what they really know? It can obviously be filled with a 10-hour course that gives you 12 and a quarter HSW learning units, but what do you think that gap typically is?
So what they're missing is a framework for understanding for how they're going to go about their professional practice, really. And this has to do with building science, but other stuff as well, too. So you have a design education, but you don't really understand building science. That's one thing. And don't really understand how things get built, like how a job is. I mean, you learn it sort of in school, but you don't appreciate it till you see it. So how is a job? The contractor doesn't actually build it himself. The contractor or herself, or what, these are teams, right? The general contractor is basically like a coordinator. They're not, mm-hmm. they're not swinging the hammer. They're also administrators. GC is an has a big administrative role, and they assign that work to subcontractors and who actually do the work, and they do it in a specific order. And understanding both building science and essentially the division of labor among trades are, I think, the really, really big gaps. And what's helpful is you don't learn those things overnight. What I think a lot of architects are operating without is a framework for understanding information related to those topics. And the example I give people is, like, you will pick this stuff up in professional practice. People do all the time. And you, depending on who you are, do a pretty reasonable job of it over a career. But you're still kind of, it's a little bit like going on a vacation abroad and picking up a phrase book for a foreign language. And you can learn some sentences in a foreign language to get by in your foreign country on a vacation and do pretty well. But if you actually had a framework, if you had a grammar and an understanding of a basic understanding of the language, well, then you can start to actually express original thought and to really communicate rather than just playing from a phrase book. And I think a lot of practicing architects and architects in training are still working off of their phrase book, and they're finding that inadequate because, you know, you try to have a conversation and you can only answer, like, there's a very limited number of questions you know how to answer with your phrase book. And you certainly have a difficult time expressing original thought. And building science and the course I teach anyway, even the individual Instagram posts, try to help develop a framework so that afterwards, like once you have the framework, afterwards you're just expanding your vocabulary and you get to be, it facilitates creativity I think most practicing professionals experience building science and constructability issues as constraints and things that limit their creativity. But if you have this framework, it's just like a language, and it starts being part of the background. You start seeing the poetry of something and enjoying the poetry of something rather than like saying subject verb, like whatever. It becomes natural. So I think that's, so what's missing, I think, a framework for understanding both building science and the division of labor among the trades is missing, and that it's leaving a lot of really talented and smart people to try to do the best they can by picking it up as they go along, by basically just memorizing stuff. And that's a very, very slow and difficult way to learn.
As someone that once used the phrase books to get to the point of ordering gelato in Venice outside of St. Mark's, I really appreciate that analogy. But yeah, it was really good gelato, though.
Always worth it in the end. Yeah.
So with all of that, what advice would you have? Let's just say if there's someone watching or someone that watches this in the future or listens to the podcast version of this in the future, that maybe they're in school now, or maybe they just graduated, maybe they're studying for the ARE. I don't know. It's a young person. Let's just say it that way. What advice do you have for them to prepare themselves? You know, as you were describing that, I grew up around construction, you know, as family and friends. And so I worked construction jobs and I spent a lot of time on job sites as a teenager and things like that. So I feel like I've got an advantage or had an advantage when I actually worked in architecture. But what would you recommend for a young person that maybe wants to accelerate or enhance their education?
I think the number one, so from a practical perspective, purely practical perspective, the best advice is to learn the names of things. Mm. Go order all those books from Francis Chang and go through them in your spare time, flip through. It doesn't have to be this giant endeavor, but learn what things are called. And if you know the names of things, you start to actually see them differently. Like, you probably do not see a soffit until you know the name of a soffit. I mean, you've seen it, but you haven't really seen it. You don't have a language for it. There's also, like, actually, if you're sort of interested in language and linguistics, as I sort of am, not in any kind of disciplined way, but there's really interesting philosophies sort of tied to that, knowing the name, having words to express thoughts and actually being able to think them as being connected. I think it's the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis. Anyway, it's a division of linguistics. It's kind of interesting. Orwell talks about it a lot too, where if your language is sloppy, it leads to sloppy thoughts. Anyway, totally different, but learn the names of things in architecture. And that's something that you can start doing no matter where you are in your studies or your ARE path or whatever. And that I find particularly enriching. You start seeing things differently. So that's something I would do that's pretty simple. Because once you start seeing things, the next step is thinking about how they're built. How did that get there? What was there first? Who installed that? Was it the same person who installed the thing that's next to that thing? The names of things is really helpful. I still do that. I still have those books. I still refer to them. I'm still learning the names of new things that I shop. And also, I'm sure people can have that shared experience where you're like, how did I not know that? I've been doing this for like a decade. Why did I never see that before?
Yep. I'm always worried about mispronouncing things that I should know. Like, you know, like a gunwale and a boat is written out like gunswale, I think, or something like that. But if you said that around somebody who knows about it, they'd laugh at you.
I never knew that.
Look up, so I've
probably
like
been
that.
Seeing it written and thinking that it's...
Right. That's a problem with seeing things written that makes me feel like mumbling on the job site. Like, that's the... Because there's always a different... It seems like it's always a different pronunciation.
There's so many... So I practice everywhere in the U.S. and abroad, too, sometimes. And it is actually really funny where some people... That's one thing I'm really grateful for Instagram for, and just having a geographically diverse professional practice, which started before Instagram. That gave me a lot more confidence because I would think that I was a moron for saying something wrong or saying something differently. And then I realized, no, you're not a moron. I just say it differently over here. Or somebody, I gave a presentation once, or I was interviewed for This Old House about window installations. And I kept calling it the flange of a window. And some commenters were like, it's a nailing fin. And they were angry, like really angry that I called it something that they didn't like. or they weren't used to. And I know that that's not wrong. I know that neither one is wrong, but because people call it different things in different places, I prefer what I call it because it's what I call it. But no judgment. But anyway, there's more than one name for something can be a little trying.
Yeah. This is where the Fight Club aspect comes in.
Right. Yep.
Nailing.
People are not intended to take too literally. I asked people if I should change the name, actually, because I was a little, it started as a joke, and then it got really big. And I'd gotten a few sort of aggressive comments on Instagram, and then, and people who had alluded to it says Fight Club in the name. I mean, so it's totally, totally cool. And construction is pretty aggressive anyway. So this is stuff we're used to spending time on sites. People get fired up. So that's okay. But I thought, well, maybe I should change the name because I don't want to encourage like actual fighting. The point is to learn. But then people, you're shaking your head, Jeff. People were overwhelmingly like, do not change the name. Like, I know it's a joke. And also it's fun and playful. And it is good to have a sort of this word is overused, I think, a lot, but a safe space to sort of hash stuff out among professionals. It's not in front of your boss, not in front of your clients, you know. So you get to kind of duke it out a bit in a hopefully fun setting, if it comes to that.
I think that ought to be like a weekly lunchtime activity at most firms. They can hash it out like that.
Right?
Yeah. You talked about earlier that you're serving clients, right? I mean, that's ultimately you're a consultant. So you have you have your practice. And one of the things I think is really impressive on your website is the clarity of, you know, you basically explain what a building scientist does, and you explain the, you know, why would you hire this and what would you expect? And it's real talk. My summarization is that it's real talk. You know, this is what it is. This is what it means. And I think that's very important. So kudos for all of that. And I know we had gotten some questions about, one, where did you find the clarity for what you wanted to do and what you love? But also, there you go, from Jay, talk about how you arrived at such clarity around your fees as well. And that I think is probably where I was headed, was how did you boil it down to the point that it's so understandable, it's so approachable, and then also attach this fee to it? You talked about hourly before, and I love the fact that you don't have hourly.
I don't do hourly anymore. Nope.
Yeah. So can you speak to that?
I really don't like it. I really, because I think hourly, first of all, it depends on what your business model is. And for a lot of people, hourly billing remains the most practical way of accounting for your labor and running your business. So, okay, it's you've got to find a way to get paid. If that's what you have to do, that's what you have to do. If you don't have to do it, though, don't think that you have to. So I don't do it. I'm a sole practitioner, and I don't like to think of projects that way. And actually, I think most people don't either. The hourly fees are sort of supposed to keep you disciplined with stuff, and maybe they do. But most of us approach our work like, look, if I'm not proud of this and I've sort of maxed out the budget, I don't care. Like my sort of time budget, I'm going to work at this until I'm proud of it. And I'm going to take the hit on the hours. So basically I'm not going to put them on my timesheet. So whatever, we do that all the time. The mental acrobatics that accompany most timesheets was just exhausting for me. So whatever, like a lot of people, I hate hourly fees. I try not to do it anyway. What I decided I wanted to do with consulting was that I'm pretty good at it. And so I thought, well, I don't need to attract I don't have a staff to keep busy. I don't have a lot of, so I don't need to take jobs that are smaller. I can take big jobs, demand a big fee, and then and tell people, like, you will not get a bill for 15 minutes for this. Like, phone calls are free. Like, everything is included. I want you to call me, because when you call me to resolve something now, I don't want you to save up questions until you have enough for a phone call or whatever. We're going to work till we get it done. Because that's how we produce, like, that's how I was working anyway. I just wasn't being paid for it. So I ask for a bigger fee, and people appreciate not being nickel and dimed. I think the hourly model sort of encourages a certain amount of nickel and diming. Like, you nickel and dime your customers, and then you train them to nickel and dime you. And I wanted to do that. So this is an experiment. I'm not speaking as some expert here. Like, I've been doing this for a year. Maybe it's worked out really well so far. Maybe it won't long term. So we'll have to have this conversation again in a few years. But in terms of how I speak about my fee and about architecture fees and the industry in general on my website, that is where Instagram has actually really helped. I recognize that I have a lot of eyes on me, even outside of the architecture world. And what I wanted to do is I wanted to write about what hiring consultants was like and what clients should really budget for that kind of stuff. Not really for myself, but more as a service to the industry, to sort of set expectations someplace. Like, if you want to hire a good team, they cost money, and the client should be prepared to pay them. And this, I think the way I speak about it gives people reasonable expectations for what they can expect to budget for the type of help that they might need. And I wanted to also dispel the idea, myth, whatever, that if an architect has to hire a consultant, that it means that they're somehow not competent on their own. Architecture has a lot of different requirements to it, and it's not unusual for somebody for a normal person, a human, to not be a specialist in all things. So a client can hire, an owner can hire an architect for a whole bunch of reasons, but they should not expect their architect to be an expert in everything. And they should anticipate that the architect will require outside help for in particular contexts, and whatever that is for the job it is, whether it's an acoustical consultant, a building scientist, they should budget accordingly. And we really feel strongly about that it's not an having to hire extra help to address specific concerns in design is not a failure, does not indicate some inherent weakness on the part of the professional at all. In fact, it's smart. It's the professional smart enough to understand their limitations and say, well, here's where we're going to spend some extra money. And it's sort of silly, because I see this attitude in architecture, but I don't see it in like construction. Like, nobody's surprised that the roofer doesn't also install the bathroom tile, you know, like, that's okay. But somehow in architecture, your architect, the same architect who is going to design your family room and your kitchen, is also meant to be a specialist on attic ventilation rates. Like, come on. It's okay to collaborate and to bring in help. And clients, whether they're residential or commercial, should be, our buildings are very complicated, and they should be prepared to put together a good team, compensate them fairly, and then let them do wonderful work and enjoy and appreciate the results. But if you don't give your team the resources to actually solve the problems that you're asking them to solve, you're not going to get a good result. You're not going to get a good solution. So anyway. Yeah. So that's what I'm really specific. Anybody listening, I'm very specific on my website about why you might need a building scientist. And it's written in a way, I'm kind of writing it for both of our clients. I mean, I'm writing it for an owner to see and to understand the process. And I'm sort of priming them to open their wallets, really. So I really wanted to convey that expertise costs money, and that people should be prepared to pay for that.
And for those of you that are listening, or well, even if you're in the live audience right now, you can find that at christine-williamson.com. That's a place that you can go and find all these things that we've been talking about here for the last few minutes, and how Christine explains it, what the fees look like, and things like that. So check that out, christine-williamson.com. Thank you to BQE, the makers of BQE Core, for their support of this podcast episode. Visit bqe.com/masterclass to register for the next Designing Your Business Masterclass. Well, what did you think? Did you hear something in there that you can use in your practice today? If you are so inspired by this conversation that you'd like to watch the entire Context and Clarity Live episode, head on over to the Entree Architect YouTube channel. There's a playlist there that has all of the full Context and Clarity Live episodes. And if you want more of the Context and Clarity podcast delivered to you every week, give us a thumbs up and subscribe wherever you consume podcasts. If you like content like this, check out Gable Media. It's a multimedia network for people that care about the built environment, and it's the home of Context and Clarity. With Gable's growing family of podcasts and video channels, I know you'll find something there that interests you. You can learn more at gablemedia.com. That's gablemedia.com. And one last thing before you go. If the topic of today's episode is of particular interest to you, join me over on Facebook today at 4 p.m. Eastern inside the Entree Architect Community Facebook group. That's where every weekday at 4 p.m. Eastern, I host Context and Clarity Conversations, and we take topics like this, and we dig deeper. We have a conversation in real time to try to find more clarity around the things that matter most to you. So thanks for listening. I hope our time together has inspired you to think about your community and your practice and how you can support those around you. We'll be back here again next week, and in the meantime, I hope you'll join me and the Entree Architect community on Facebook today at 4 p.m. Eastern so that we can help each other find more clarity around the topics that matter most, no matter what your context is.
From historic homes to modern architecture, brick is one of the most popular building materials around the world.
How to allow the house to bridge the gap between the history of the site, the approachability of this kind of architecture in this kind of neighborhood, and the sort of nostalgia of materiality for the client's past, right? And brick really started to provide an answer for that.
Hi, I'm Doug Pat, and this is Design Vault. There aren't many materials that easily blend with any style and context, but brick does just that. I've seen some extraordinary work with brick, so when Glengarry approached me about hosting this podcast, I couldn't say no.
Typically, Tudor-style houses from outside are just stunningly gorgeous piece of structure. And when you go in, it's just sad.
Yeah.
Dark. And that is not going to happen with my approach to design.
I speak with industry leaders and share inspiring stories behind their work and ingenious design.
You'll see brick that's fashioned into basket weave patterns, sawtooth patterns, what's known in England as diapering.
Doesn't sound like you knew them per se, right? They found you through relationships that you had with other.
Well, wait, Doug, there's more.
Okay.
We'll go behind the scenes to understand process and even the inspiration that sparked the design.
You know, I think we were inspired by all the factory buildings in Dumbo. I mean, that is the kind of period of significance, that early American factory building.
Design Vault by Glengarry. Visit glengarry.com/design-vault or search for Design Vault wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe now to stretch your imagination.